Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 82. It's August 21st, 2020. With the lineup set, the next task was to find another record deal. And here's where I feel like I really earned my keep as a Sleep at the Wheels band leader. I'm good at the hustle, and I'm also good at the schmooze, better than just about anyone I know. Always have been, because it comes naturally. Thanks, Dad. But I've worked at it, too. Over the years, I've kind of perfected hanging out as an art form. Hanging out and being a mastermind band leader might be my two best skills. Being open to people from all walks of life and willing to see the good in them has stood me well, too. As I've discovered, most folks really do have an interesting side. Might not be obvious at first, so drawing it out of them might take some effort. But it's just about always there if you're willing to spend the time to get to it. I've spoken at a lot of colleges about entrepreneurial marketing and how to go about promoting your brand, whether it's music or something else. The most important part of that is networking, which is nothing more than hanging out with the people you want to be like. Whether it's joining the country club to get into the same foursome as the CEO of a company you want to work for, or selling pot to get a gig, it's kind of the same principle. Hanging out was part of our job with Asleep at the Wheel, even when we weren't playing a show. Either we were jamming, seeing someone else play, seeing a girl, getting drunk, getting high, or all of the above. Whatever it took to try and wind up at the right place at the right time to meet someone who could help us out. As I've discovered on more than one occasion, the back door is often a better way in than the front door. But always remember that while a lot of it is who you know, you've also got to know enough to be able to make yourself useful once you get the right person's attention. I really do think the world would be a much happier place if more people would just try to be, you know, nicer. There are some Asleep at the Wheel alumni who might find that statement funny coming from me, and I can't deny having my assholish moments. After all, everybody does. But for the most part, I like everybody and try to treat them with respect. From the people I'm playing on stage with to the folks taking drink orders out in the crowd. I've got no use for cliques, and I can get along with almost anybody, even people I don't agree with about much of anything. George W. Bush, for example. Known and liked him for many years, since before he was in politics. Still a good friend. He had us to the White House. And I've always thought he absolutely should not have been president, no way, no how. He knows I didn't vote for him, but it doesn't mean that he and I don't get along then or now. Still, if you think politics are tribal, try the freaking music business, which is overflowing with misfits, geniuses, hucksters, jivers, and too many outright frauds to count. Despite it all, somehow, great things do happen at least some of the time, but it can be an ugly, brutal world, especially in the upper reaches. A friend of mine named John Draper worked for everybody from Dr. Hook to Journey in the 1970s, then the Jacksons' Victory Tour in the 80s, then Prince, who he never met despite working for him for a year. And finally, Madonna. He was the poor bastard she was yelling at all the time in that movie Truth or Dare, during which she also punched him in the stomach. A year later, he'd had enough and quit the circus. Another friend, Joel Dorn, produced Roberta Flack, Leon Redbone, Bette Midler, and lots of others over the years. He came away from the experience with psychic scars a mile wide. Ray, Joel once told me, rock and roll is a horrible place with the worst people in the world. If you want to turn yourself into a one-name superstar, the only way to do that is to hate someone. Even toward my end of the food chain, it seems like we can't get out of our own way too much of the time. People in music seem to thrive on the cult of minor differences, which holds that the more alike we are, the bigger those small differences between us become. I think it was Freud who came up with that. Whoever thought it up, it's right on the money, because a lot of people in music seem to regard success with something between disdain and fear. I even wrote about a song about it once. The smaller the potatoes, the bigger the beef. In recent years, there's been this one band that shall remain nameless, another Western Swing type group that ought to be our best buds. We love Bob Wills and they do too. So what's to disagree about? But because Asleep at the Wheel doesn't do every little thing exactly the way they think it should be done, they make us the devil. Now sometimes, similarly inclined bands do help each other out, but when they don't, look out. Because it's eat your young time, especially with bands just starting out. That's when they'll come up with these dumbass rules about what's cool, not cool, acceptable. You know, it's only cool if you wear flannel, play vintage instruments or new instruments, or do this, that, or the other. Worrying about crap like that is just a stupid waste of time. The way I look at it is that we're all of us crazy out here, and ain't none of us getting rich, not really, compared to the super wealthy. So everybody might as well just relax and enjoy the ride. The cosmos is so infinitely unfathomable, and we're all just specks. So why sweat the small stuff? Being a good sport not only helps keep the bitterness in check, it also brings good things your way. I'm a firm believer in the idea that you get back what you put out there. Burn bridges in showbiz, and they tend to stay that way. It's a lot easier to get out than to get back in. Between Joe Kerr's efforts and my boundless wit and charm, Asleep at the Wheel bounced back fairly quickly from United Artists giving us the old heave-ho. We soon wound up on a new label, Epic Records, signed by the president of the label, no less, a fellow named Don Ellis. We were back in business. The other major thing that happened as 1973 turned into 1974 was that we up and moved again for what turned out to be the last time. Asleep at the Wheel had done well in the Bay Area, definitely kicking things up a notch during our time there, but it still never felt like our final destination. And after touring all over with Stony and on our own, it was the wide open spaces of Texas that seemed to suit us best of all, fittingly enough. After all, there's a reason Bob Wills called his band the Texas Playboys. We'd met Doug Somm in the Bay Area, and he was whispering in our ear about how we should move to Austin. So was Willie Nelson, who we'd played with a good bit by then. Willie told us we belonged there, and it seemed like good advice, especially when he told us that if we moved to Texas, we would be in high demand. Hell, said Willie said, if you can play Cotton Eye Joe and Fraulein, you can work all week. The final nudge, once again, came from our old friends, Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. We'd first played Austin with them in February 1973 at the Armadillo World Headquarters, and returned there with them that November when they recorded a weekend of shows for their album Live from Deep in the Heart of Texas. Whenever we walked into the Armadillo, it just felt like home. So that was it. Asleep at the Wheel was Texas bound, pulling up the stakes and moving to Austin. We had a new hometown to go with our new record company. By then, the road had hardened us into a loud and proud onstage beast capable of standing up to almost anything. Winona Judd once said Asleep at the Wheel was like the circus, and we were because we had to be. It didn't take us long to figure out that we'd have to do a lot more than just play to win rock crowds over with country music. One night, we were playing a bar in Baltimore and just dying. Nothing happening. We were losing people, the air going out of the room. So I yelled over at Lucky, "Do something." And what Lucky did was to get up from his steel guitar and start dancing like an absolute madman. The crowd went nuts, and it became a regular part of the show. Sometimes at bigger places, Lucky would go climbing up the speakers and even into the rafters, which would piss off road crews, bouncers, and barmaids. But we had to have that rock and roll mentality because we were up against loud rock bands hollering about getting it on. I respect that, but it's not what we were built for. So we compensated with showmanship. Lucky would dance, I'd juggle and play guitar behind my head. We all told a lot of jokes. Buddy Miller, who almost joined us in the 80s but went his own way instead, told me once that Asleep at the Wheel sometimes felt dangerous when we really got going, because we were playing music people had no idea how to move to. And Emmylou Harris described us as being like one of those old black and white cartoons where everything in the store comes to life late at night, playing music and swaying. Mostly, we just wanted to make fun for everybody and the crowd alike, us and the crowd alike. We always took the music super seriously, but we hated the bands that were so damn super serious about themselves that they just stare at the ground. Where we really ran into that was at bluegrass festivals. Most of the audiences there liked us fine, but the puritanical types from the musical Border Patrol would be sniffing, not only are they not bluegrass, they're not even really Western swing. Yeah, no, Sherlock. We arrived in Austin during the winter of 1973-74, a time when it was a laid-back, cosmic cowboy paradise for refugees fleeing the big city. Seemed like all the twangy misfits from New York, Nashville, and L.A. were headed there. Austin had kind of a gulf between the hippie cowboy bands and the blues bands, but not in my head. I wanted a sleep of the wheel to bridge that gap with blues and rhythm and blues as part of what we did. The Armadillo was the center of the scene in Austin, a big barn of a concert hall beer garden just across the river from downtown. It was an old armory that had been turned into a 1,500-capacity concert hall, and just about everybody who was anybody played there when it was open during the 70s. Willie was a regular, as were a lot of locals, but the Armadillo was also big with the touring acts coming through town. That Bruce Springsteen guy played there on his way up before anybody knew who he was. And the Armadillo was one of Van Morrison's favorite places in America, especially because of the shrimp enchiladas. Asleep at the Wheel played our first gig as a local band at Palmer Auditorium, a firefighter benefit on a bill with Hank Thompson and our man, Ernest Tubb. We started working the local circuit, which included the Armadillo, as well as Soap Creek Saloon and Castle Creek. We quickly worked up to being a decent local draw, but we were still flat on our ass broke, even after getting another record deal. Chris and I were living in a house with some friends in North Austin off Runberg Lane, and we kept getting our power turned off because we couldn't afford to pay the electric bill. Our neighbors took pity and were kind enough to let us plug an extension cord into one of their outlets to keep our refrigerator going. Thanks, Bob and Carmen. Despite our continued poverty, we found Austin a groovy place to be. Rent was cheap and pot cheaper still, and good music, beautiful women, and great barbecue were everywhere. Austin was the cultural capital of the Southwest and one of the hubs of America's Underground Railroad, a post-hippie and pre-yuppie conglomerate of musicians, dope dealers, legislators, and college types with Texas' finest beatniks, artists, writers, raconteurs, all mixed together in an almost rural small-town setting. All of us had two things in common: total disrespect for the established order and a healthy appetite for life as defined by wine, women, and song. It was a scene like no other. The filmmaker Richard Linklater captured a lot of Austin's oddball vibe with his movie Slacker, which was filmed in the late 80s and caught the tail end of the old Austin. Everybody's version of the old or real Austin ended the day after they got to town, and they wonder why it's not there anymore. Well, it done got bulldozed from too many people wanting in on the fun and moving there. It's still a great place. I'll always love and have a hard time picturing myself any place else because I've just got too many friends here to leave. But it's changed a lot and kind of priced itself out of the market for most artists and musicians, even if a lot of the same old-timers like me are still hanging around. Some years back, when high-tech was in the midst of one of its booms, I was asked to come speak at a business conference. The discussion leader was Michael Dell, founder, CEO of Dell Computers, and one of the richest billionaires on Earth. He likes me because I'm the only Jewish cowboy he knows. Anyway, I was asked about the difference between Austin then and now. Well, I said, in 1973, we used to come to Austin to drop acid. Now we drop an acid. Hey, they asked. Dell turned about three shades of white, but it's true. Saying that was probably what got me into the Austin Music Awards Hall of Fame. All right, so obviously went looking for a little bit about when Ray Benson, this is his book, Coming Right at You, How a Jewish Yankee Hippie Went Country, or the often outrageous history of Asleep at the Wheel, Ray Benson and David Menconi. It is a really great book. And just in this little passage, I mean, it's nice to peek in again at our favorite cultural touchstone and home base in spirit, the Armadillo World Headquarters. It's always wonderful to see everybody's view of it. It's great to think about somebody, Ray Benson, I think from Philadelphia. In here he's, you know, saying they just come from the Bay Area, but deciding to come to town. Willie serving as Pied Piper, as is often the case in these stories, bringing such people to town. And Ray also, just in these few pages, offers some really interesting ideas. He's a heck of an entrepreneur and a salesman. He's had to be so to maintain his standing in this business, and it is a business, show business. And Ray's awesome. He was a client of Amplifier for a long time back in the day. Some of our music clients think we got out of music. We really didn't. It was just at the timing we quit running the shops and asked our clients to run the shops. It's worked out rather well for us, and I think it's worked out rather well for all the musicians. We had a couple hundred Austin Music Access clients in the day, all in our store. Ray's awesome. I've never seen anybody quite like Ray. Ray is equally at home and respected, as far as I can tell, with the indie artists that just literally got off the bus in Austin and, you know, the head of Sony Nashville or something. Ray can move authentically, completely naturally, all over the place. So his knocking down the idea of clicks here and his exhortations to be nicer, to see the best in people, to understand that everybody's got an interesting side and how to draw it out of them. He lives and breathes that. He really does. And I have to say, as somebody who was an early, you know, follower of Willie here, we owe him a huge debt, because a lot of those qualities have risen up around him, tributary to his orientation there. He's really walked that talk. From our experience too at Amplifier, the music business, it does seem like it is pretty cutthroat, and there's a lot of yelling and hollering and shoving people around. So anybody that can keep their head about them and have a bit of grace through it all has really accomplished quite a lot. And of course, he also mentions that everybody wants Austin to quit growing the moment after they land, and it just doesn't work that way. And that's okay. It's not as cheap as it once was. It will be interesting to see what happens over the next 20 years, say. And can we integrate from, you know, Taylor to, you know, Del Valley to, and Elgin and Dripping Springs and Fredericksburg, all the hill country where people can live around here and still make it. There is still a lot of magic in Austin, Texas, and it's more expensive than it was when he got here in 74, dramatically so, but so are a lot of places. I wanted to continue and do another, to go back to Eddie Wilson's memoir called Armadillo World Headquarters, fittingly enough. Let me see if I can find where I wanted to start. This also kind of captures the what I love about these stories. I mean, I just love the Armadillo. I love that it was a music venue. I love that it was a cultural community center hosting makers and ballet and speeches and poets and served food. And it was a sort of much closer than is typical here. We'll call places pubs, but they're not quite like the classic sort of UK pub, but the Armadillo sure seems like it was. So let me pick up here. This is, as with Ray's book, this Armadillo stuff is happening. This particular part's about two-thirds of the way in, maybe. In retrospect, we were doing a pretty good job at what we did best. Over 6 weeks in the spring of 1974, we had Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, the Austin Ballet Theater, Freddie King, Kinky Friedman and his Texas Jew Boys, John McLaughlin, and the Mahavishnu Orchestra, Leo Kottke, the Jay Giles Band, and those reliable Western Swing, Rockabilly Madmen, Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. Cody returned for two more nights, sharing the bill with another Western Swing band, asleep at the wheel. Two guys from Philadelphia, Ray Benson and Lucky Oceans, had formed Asleep at the Wheel in Paw Paw, West Virginia in 1969. They played some shows, opening for Alice Cooper and Hot Tuna in Washington, D.C., and in 1970 they relocated to East Oakland, California. I'd met the guys when I was visiting in Berkeley, hyping up the Armadillo to Joe Kerr, who managed both Asleep at the Wheel and Commander Cody. "Come to Austin," I told Ray Benson, Asleep at the Wheel's frontman. "Y'all can be the house band at the Armadillo." They took me up on the offer and played their first show at the joint in the spring of 1973. The house band promise didn't work out, but we gave them plenty of work. Benson said, "We came to Austin because it's where the music is." The Wheel was a big ensemble made up of players who lived and breathed Western swing. They were brimming with talent, determination, and personality. By now, Austin had more than its share of great new-style country bands, Frida and the Fire Dogs, Man Mountain, and Alvin Crow, along with hardcore redneck combos like Jess Demain, Johnny Lyon, Janet Lynn, and the Country New Notes, and whatever band was currently being led by Bert Rivera, Hank Thompson's former pedal steel player. When it came to carrying the Bob Wills baton, Asleep at the Wheel gave no quarter. Bandleader Ray Benson was a 6'7" tall, red-haired Jewish boy from Philadelphia. He looked like a baby giraffe with a cowboy hat. If the mellifluous drawl that rolled out of Ray's mouth didn't convince you that the ensemble deserved a place in the pantheon of authentic Texas music, then their hit Miles and Miles of Texas would surely do so. The Wheel's female vocalist, Chris O'Connell, sounded like she'd been raised by Tammy Wynette. Pianist Floyd Domino banged on the ivories, hands crisscrossing, rhythm and counter-rhythm exploding out of the box with the kind of fury that could turn a graveyard into a dancing ballroom. Tony Garnier thumped the upright bass like a beatnik cat. Holding down the pedal steel chair was a fellow who used the name Lucky Oceans, but who was known in a previous life as Reuben Gosfeld, just as Ray Seifert had become Ray Benson and Jim Haber was now known as Floyd Domino. Leroy Preston, a fresh-faced lad from Vermont with a penchant for writing twisted lyrics, for example, "Hello, everybody, I'm a dead man," was born with a stage name. The guys in The Wheel and the Lost Planet Airmen often had their axes handy when they were hanging out, and they were prone to jam at the drop of a hat. The beer garden and the backstage area were never as much fun as when Cody and The Wheel shared the bill at the Dillo. They also kept the kitchen busy. Each band might have set an all-time record for consuming Armadillo food. In a pound-per-band comparison between these two and the Charlie Daniels band, you might assume the latter had the edge, since it took a lot of feed to satisfy a guy like Charlie, who weighed over 300 pounds. But the two hippie Western swing bands were bigger ensembles. Cody and Ray also burned more energy. They tended to act more like growing boys on a vacation at Grandma's house. Instead of napping after gorging, they'd play volleyball against the Dillo crew and then jam some more, teaching each other licks and lyrics they'd recently picked up, laughing like fools. The Wheel acclimated quickly to Austin. In the beginning, Floyd Domino camped at Bobby Hederman's house, and Ray Benson let his feet dangle off my guest bed until the band scouted more permanent digs. Before a year was up, most of the band members were well established in South Austin. Awesome stuff. And so here we have Eddie out in Berkeley. The Armadillo opened in 70, so he's out there in 73. Not that that was his first time out there. I'm sure he'd been out there dozens of times. But offering to Ray to be the house band at the Armadillo when they come to Texas. And now I've got Willie Nelson and Epic Life by Joe Nick Petoskey in my hands. Let me see here. 500-page biography, more or less, of Willie by Joe Nick, who's just an incredible writer and storyteller. And this provides a lot of color, too, about Ray, about Austin, and about Willie. So I want to, while I've got your attention, if I do, to share this as well. Willie didn't spend a whole lot of time crying over a picnic gone bad or over losing his deal with Atlantic Records. From the front porch of his ranch, life looked pretty good. The move to Texas that was supposed to mark the end of his career had revived it instead. His blood family and his musical family were living around him. Musicians were streaming into Austin in droves in search of the scene he helped build. The national media were taking note of the scene boiling up in Texas, and its ringleader, who had been anointed in Austin as Godfather, was regarded as almost as big a deal in Dallas and Houston. What was there not to like? The Willie Effect was directly responsible for the much-publicized relocation of the band Asleep at the Wheel from Northern California to Texas at the end of the summer of 1974. Choice slots on picnics, numerous shared bills with Willie, and a history at the Armadillo through their friends Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen made the move a no-brainer. "We were already known," the pianist Floyd Domino said. "We were on the radio in Austin. Townsend Miller wrote us up. We were in. We were nobodies out in Berkeley. I've never been a strong melody player. I just keyed off the chords. But in Texas, people would come up and say, 'I like how you solo. You solo like Al Strickland. You play out on the edge like Jimmy Day.' We were a natural fit there." We were a natural fit down here. The Wheel played a week at the Armadillo, living in the parking lot on their tour bus. "We were booked to play 6 nights at the Western Place in Dallas, but after 2 nights, Juno McCausland, the owner, said, 'You're not playing, Willie's playing,'" Floyd said. "Juno wanted to kick them off the bill. They'd drawn 12 paying customers the first night and not many more the second, no matter how well they played Western Swing and sounded like Bob Wills. When Willie showed up, the Wheel told him they'd been bumped from the bill. Willie told Juno in no uncertain terms, 'They don't play, I don't play.' Juno immediately starts kissing our ass," Floyd said. "Juno was a real stand-up guy. Our road manager, Baggett, was a black belt in karate, and Juno put his gun on the table when they were settling up. Baggett asked him, 'Is that faster than my hand?' We got paid, no problem." The Wheel's introduction to characters like Juno was instructive. Juno was having a small war with a vending machine distributor over pool tables in the club. At one point, he removed the pool tables, put them on the sidewalk, and said, "Come get your effing pool tables." The next week, on Saturday night, the place was packed. When 3 Doberman pinchers were set loose in the club as retaliation, clearing out the place. That's the kind of people we were dealing with, Ray Benson, Asleep at the Wheel's leader, concluded. Juno attracted trouble, yet Willie always did business with him. Did Juno have something on him, or was this loyalty of the most extraordinary degree? Ray Benson developed a theory. The more you screwed up, the more Willie liked you. Ray had already learned a lot about the business from Willie when they met on the road in Greenville, South Carolina, early in 1972. Asleep at the Wheel was backing up Connie Smith, Stoney Edwards, Freddie Hart, Vicki Lee, and the rest of a package show that Willie was joining. "We were really excited because we knew who Willie Nelson was," Ray said. They pulled up in that open road mobile home with Bee and Paul. The first thing Willie asked us was whether we'd been paid. It was the 4th show that week and no one had been paid. Otis Woody, the promoter, told everybody not to worry, that we'd be paid on the next date. Ray got to drinking Jack Daniels and talking about dope with Paul English and Bee Spears when Willie interrupted the conversation. "Come on, boys, we're going home," he said without further discussion. Willie saw that the promoter didn't have the money, wasn't going to pay him, so he said, "F you," and went home, Ray said. That's how I met Willie Nelson. Ray Benson realized he was witnessing the start of something big at Juno's new club in Dallas, 57 Doors. The room was a dump, but the gigs were amazing. We played Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, starting at 9, 4 alternating sets. On Thursday, there were 40 people in the club. By Saturday, it was packed. These strippers came in who just worshipped Willie Nelson. They would say, "You speak to me." People were fanatically devoted to Willie. Waylon Jennings was supposed to be the star. He was sexy. The women loved him. Willie was goofy, a hippie like all the rest of us. He was also a certified rabble-rouser. Things started turning ugly at the Texas Opry House after Willie's endorsement of the Opry at the expense of the Armadillo helped ignite bidding wars over several acts, including Willie, Waylon, Boss Gags, and Ray Charles. "I wrote a column in The Statesman knocking the Opry people for stealing Ray Charles," said Joe Gracie, the paper's rock and roll columnist and the Coke FM disc jockey. "They threatened to kill me," he claimed. "They put out a hit on me with some thug in San Marcos." Gracie's worry over the threat was short-lived. Despite the crowds, the Texas Opry House folded less than a year after it opened. Bronson Evans hadn't paid rent in 2 months and suddenly disappeared with no forwarding address. Wally Selman faced tax evasion charges for failing to withhold income tax on the Opry's employees. The beer license people was on me. The liquor license people was on me. They pulled my license. The whole house of cards fell. They come out and put tape on the doors. The IRS locked the doors, and they didn't give me no key. Wally went to Willie for help. He found him in a booth at the Opry Annex, which remained open. "I need some money or I'm going to jail," Wally pleaded. "You know what we used to do in Fort Worth when a place we played had financial trouble?" Willie asked him. Wally shook his head. "We'd go somewhere else and play." Wally's heart sank. "We'll help," Willie said, laughing, once he knew he had made Wally squirm. Willie and band played 5 nights at the Opry Annex Club to pay off debts and make sure neither Wally Selman nor anyone else had to go to jail for having too good a time. Waylon joined the shows, asking only that Wally pay for his rooms at the Holiday Inn on Town Lake, where he liked to stay. Wallace Selman paid the taxes, stayed out of jail, and went to Houston and opened another Texas Opry house. And Willie Nelson got a new record label. I'll stop there. Obviously, I could just read all 500 pages. It's colorful as hell. And you just keep turning over these things and finding these little bits of magic and fun. And just appreciate the ride they were all on, the adventure they were all on. And Willie Nelson's really something. There will never be another. There will never be another like him, obviously. And all of Austin owes him a debt. If you've never seen this series, I believe for HBO, I'll find it. I don't think it's online where I can just link to it, but I'll find information about it, post it at regular.fm/82. Dave Grohl did a very idiosyncratic sort of series about these music places important to him. And each city has an episode: Seattle, Los Angeles, Nashville, Austin. And I say idiosyncratic because not like the LA episode is a perfect comprehensive survey of, you know, the directory of musical things about Los Angeles. It's a very, very personal take on his ride through that place. And in fact, they roll out of town to a studio a little bit out of town. Great episode. The Austin episode's really good. They, of course, talk to Willie. They, of course, go to Austin City Limits, the old studio. And what's amazing is the Nashville episode is also wonderful about Austin. Because in the Nashville episode, the people they're talking to are talking about how in their day jobs, they work for Music Row. And on nights and weekends, they get to create what they want. And they say, basically, and, you know, it's not like Austin. This isn't Austin. And Steve Earle, I think this is where I've seen this line from Steve Earle. It's a very incisive line. He says, you know, Nashville loves singers and loves songwriters. Didn't really like singer-songwriters. And that's why Willie came back here. In the end, much more money flows through Nashville. Much more money flows through Los Angeles. The big corporate jobs in New York. The big corporations are there. The big labels are there. The big corporate jobs are there. That's true. Even today, even if you stack up Austin against Athens, Georgia, Athens, Georgia's had a lot of bands come through there and get quite big. I believe the B-52s, REM, Drive-By Truckers, a lot over the years, right? We have Gary Clark Jr. here now, thriving and doing great. Willie's done great. Stevie Ray Vaughan was lost too soon. Joe Nick, by the way, wrote a biography of him. But Austin, going all the way back, and it's interesting for Benson to cite Slacker, you know, Austin hasn't prized money first, commerce first, at least not these artists. That's not what drew them here. I think... To an extent, you know, it's a false dichotomy. You can have it both ways. And certainly Willie's produced untold amounts of revenue and gross receipts. And who knows how many people have made excellent livings in his wake for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. and people still come here, and it's getting bigger and better. I don't know. Just while thinking about Austin, like, it's very interesting to watch different sectors. Consumer packaged goods is doing very well in Austin, CPG. And Austin actually seems to punch above its weight in that domain, whereas in things like gaming and software and even music, it doesn't necessarily. It is without question an amazing place to live and experience music. I am in serious withdrawal of live music because of COVID and these shutdowns. I will be very glad when we can all go do that again, from the Continental Club Gallery and the Saxon Pub to big shows. I'm just incredibly eager for that to come back. Another thing I really appreciate here is Asleep at the Wheel. I think it was Floyd Domino saying when he got here that they couldn't get anywhere in Berkeley in the Bay Area, and they were getting played on the radio and written about here, and fans would come up to them with incredibly literate commentary and compliments. You sound like this, and you remind me of that. Austin has the same reputation in film, that the people here care. They're dialed in. They know. So that is a real benefit for the artists, I hope. It's definitely a benefit for all of us. So I wanted to get back in there. I wanted to pay a little tribute to Ray Benson. Found these three. Hopefully, you know, we need Willies and Rays and Waylands in their 20s and 30s and 40s. We really do. So for all of us, what we can do is continue the fine tradition of giving a damn and paying attention and knowing and getting out and experiencing this, the creativity and the artistry, paying these people and thanking them. It's a big, big deal. It's a big, big part of this place. We need to keep it. Thanks, y'all.